Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Guess what we're going to talk about today? Yeah, the election. Uh-huh. Well, you've probably been overloaded with all the talk about that. But let me focus on the economic side of all this. Let's talk about the economics of why Trump won, and then, most importantly, the economic consequences of the Trump presidency, both for the U.S. and globally as well. Okay, let's start with why he won. And as you probably, if you've been reading my blog and listening to some of these shows since the summer, I've been raising the red flag that, this guy has more appeal than you think. People are fed up with the Democrats and the inability to achieve anything for Main Street for the last 8 years, pretty much. And, you know, if you look longer term, the Democrats are really in decline. It's been going on for at least two decades or more here. You can think about Obama as an aberration in the longer trend ever since the mid-1990s. People voted for Obama in large numbers in 2008 because they thought he would bring the change. And, of course, he didn't bring the change. And now people want a change again. That's all they're voting for. They want a change. They're sick and tired of this corporate neoliberal policy mix that's been going on now for quite some time. You know, if you look at the Democrats, how they performed under Obama here, they came into office with 257 House seats, and they only have 193. The Senate, they had a filibuster-proof majority. Now they have a minority. 29 governorships in 2008. Now they're down to half at 15. Only 60 of the 99 state legislative chambers they had in 2010, now they have 30. I mean, they've just about collapsed. And yet people say, oh, well, we got to help them out, and next time around, we're going to have to get somebody better, right? Reform them from the inside. Reform the Democratic Party, the inside strategy, as they call that, right? That was Bernie Sanders' strategy, and they're still trying to do that. Well, I don't think it's going to produce anything more than it's already produced. People should start thinking about something else. The Democratic Party, of course, had a chance with Bernie, and they crapped on him during the whole primary season, and they could have had a candidate that would have given a change, because people wanted a change. That's all. They want a change. They don't know what else they want. They know they don't want what they got, whether it's George Bush or the economics of Obama. And as I've been saying in writing, the key to the election here was going to be the working class in the Great Lakes States area. I mean, read my blog. Go back, jackrasmus.com. Go read the postings and the articles that have been published here since this summer. This election was a Brexit 2.0. You know, Brexit, where the working class in England voted against the political elite there to stay in the European Union. And the polls said, oh, the vote was they're going to remain. And the polls, of course, were absolutely wrong, because the pollsters aren't polling the working class very accurately. And the same thing, exact same thing happened here in this election. People are tired of this globalization, excuse me, and all that it means in terms of lost jobs, stagnant wages, no opportunities, low-paid service jobs, part-time temp contract, gig work, they lose the high-end jobs, and they get these low-end jobs. And Obama and Democrats brag about that. Well, the people who got them aren't bragging about that, particularly the millennials, who don't see much hope of getting outside of these kind of low-end jobs, especially after they have $1 trillion in debt to get them. Hmm? For 8 years here, we've had near zero interest rates, and grandma and grandpa retirees, 50 million of them, no savings whatsoever, while the banks take those low interest rates and the corporations take advantage of those low interest rates, borrow money for free virtually from the Fed, right, and go use it to pay back stocks, buy back their stocks, pay out dividends. And banks use it to borrow at virtually nothing and loan it out to speculators and offshore. Yeah, Federal Reserve policy, zero interest rates, QE, all that's been great for the financial sector. They love it. They've essentially transferred trillions of dollars from retirees who can't save a penny and given it to the banks and speculators. Yeah, that's the policy of low interest rates for 8 years. And that's the policy for the jobs. Yeah, we've created jobs, but almost virtually most of them are low-pay jobs, you know, with no security, with no benefits. That's why 40% of millennials in their 20s are living at home with their parents. They can't afford to live anywhere else. 40% of them can't get going, can't start families, etc. Yeah, that's a legacy, all right. Hmm? Big tech companies, right, continue to hoard trillions of dollars overseas to avoid paying taxes. Immersions, right, just change the headquarters, location of your company, and you avoid paying all kinds of taxes, billions and billions of taxes. That's what the big tech companies do. Why, they bring in hundreds of thousands of legal immigrants on H-1B and L-1 visas to take prime jobs that many Americans would like in the tech industry. And then we target the poor Latino workers who come into this country to take up jobs Americans don't want. You know, cleaning your hotel rooms and watching your kids, middle class, you know, families, two-income professional families. They watch their kids, the nannies. Hmm? They cook your food in the restaurants and serve you in the restaurants and everything. They do the gardening. They pick the agriculture products. Yeah. They do the low-pay construction work. Yeah, they're the problem. No, they're not the problem. If you want to talk about immigration and problems, talk about the tech companies and bringing hundreds of thousands in to take good-paying jobs. But you won't hear, you didn't hear anything of that, did we, in the election from either of the candidates. Big pharmaceutical companies continue to price gouge, causing people to literally die. College students, more than $1 trillion in debt. Latino minorities deported in record numbers, breaking up thousands of families. Police militarization and violence of repressing African Americans in the inner cities. Unchecked fracking of poisoning water supplies and air, and the country's infrastructure rapidly rotting as a result. That's the legacy of the last 8 years, and no wonder white working class, particularly those who don't have the benefit of a college education, although the benefit is not so great anymore, it seems, you know, I mean, they rebelled. They said they held their nose. You know, repeatedly, 60 to 80% of those polled did not like Trump. 60 to 80%, but they voted for him anyway. How do you explain that? Well, you explain it. They don't want any of the above of what they've been getting under Bush and Obama, and before that, Clinton, and before that, Reagan. They don't want it anymore. Give us something different. We don't know what it is, but we don't want that anymore. It's killing us. You know, American voters said anything but the above. They didn't care about Trump's political warts, past or present, and his outrageous statements and so forth. They just wanted to stick their thumb in the eye of the political elites of both parties. You know, in a sense, they said, you, political elite, you've hurt and harmed us these past 8 years. You ignored us, left us behind while ensuring your wealthy friends recovered quickly and well from the last crash. We've experienced great anxiety and security. Now have a taste of that yourself. That's what it is. Of course, they may be fooled here in that, but I can understand why they did what they did. I can understand that. You know, and as I predicted in articles I've been writing, I said this election is going to be determined in the manufacturing arc between Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, the manufacturing geographic area that was manufacturing in this country, but it's been devastated. It's like a war zone. Factories gone, shut down. Gone where? Well, just about everywhere. Certainly Mexico, you know, Canada, China, everywhere. They just stripped the country of its manufacturing base and sent it off. But, you know, it's not just free trade here. It's not just free trade. What's not being talked about are the massive business tax cuts that have been enacted since Bush that have allowed the companies that didn't move out to replace their workers with machinery and new technology. We are still producing the same level of output of manufactured goods, but we're producing it with 6 million fewer workers. Now, half of those workers have been lost. You know, the auto parts industry moved totally to Mexico. Part of it's been lost to free trade, but part of it's been lost to mechanization. Automation, whatever you want to talk about, right? And that's been the tax cuts. The tax cuts have enabled businesses to move out and get a tax benefit by moving out of the country. The tax cuts have also enabled them to replace workers with the technology, the new machinery, robots, right? Robot welders, auto industry, whatever. But you don't hear much about that, you see. Half of the jobs lost have been lost because of new technology. And you look at the tech industry, you know, all these booming companies and everything. Well, they offshore most of their work, you know. They subcontract it out to software engineers and coders and so forth all around the world. They just keep a core here in the U.S., a core R&D. That's it. Doesn't produce the jobs that it once did. Plus, they're bringing in a whole bunch of hundreds of thousands, 300,000 tech jobs are here on H-1B visas. So, you know, people have said, enough, you know. And it didn't matter what Trump did, you know. I mean, his stupid statements, outrageous, misogynist, racist statements off the cuff, right, his lack of any government experience, only enhanced his view that he was not another political elite politician. He didn't spend much on TV ads. He had no ground game organization to turn out the vote. The press and media say he lost the three TV debates. He had a poorly run Republican Party convention. All that was irrelevant. People would have voted for anybody but the above. They want to change. Now, the change they get may not be all that nice, you know, and they will find out, and then they'll want another change. And the question is, are we going to go back and forth here between Democrats and Republicans? You know, the Republicans come in and they make their class rich, and they destroy the economy in the process, and then the Democrats come in and they repair the economy for the rich, not for the rest of us, and make them even richer. And we go back and forth between this. And it's gone on for decades now. These are two wings of the single corporate party of America. And they have this game going, you see. And people forget after 4 years and they listen to the great promises. You know, Obama's great promises didn't pan out, and now we got these great promises from Trump that won't pan out either. And people desperate just keep saying, give me something different, give me something different. You know, and anyone who tries to provide something different ends up like Bernie Sanders. They maneuvered him out. And yet he still throws in his support for them because they believe you can reform this corporate-dominated party called the Democrats from the inside. You can't. They won't let you. Watch. In the wake of all this, the Democratic Party is going to tighten up its rules. They'll never let another Sanders run. Right? They won't clean house here, which they should. You know, the Warrens and the Sanders will be voices still in the left wilderness of that party. Nothing's going to really change. It's the polls, the political polls and the corporate elite within the party who run the party and who had this disastrous strategy. They thought, you know, you get all these experts on ground game, turn out the vote, and all the TV spending, you know, all the scientific electoral means and measures would get them a victory. Right? Well, you know, what's happening here is that, to use the jargon of the past, the masses are entering the political equation. Now, they're still trying to do it within the two-party system, and they're going to be disappointed with that, but they're in movement early. And the question is, will they be able to break out of the straitjacket of this two-party system and make a change? The root of the Trump victory economically lies in the past 8 years and the deep failure of the policies of the Barack Obama administration. Hillary Clinton wasn't defeated by Trump, but by this failed performance of the last 8 years. People just want something different. Okay. What were the consequences of these 8 years? Well, we saw it, right? Corporate profits more than doubled, benefiting the stock and bond markets. The wealthiest 1-5% households, you know, the investors who own these corporations, right, were paid more than $5 trillion in stock buybacks and dividends. More than $1 trillion in each of the last 2 years going up. $5 trillion, they got the pocket. And the tax cuts allowed them to keep it. First the Bush tax cuts, and then Obama just continues the Bush tax cuts. You know, and in at the end of 2012, really 2013, the Democrats agree to extending for another 10 years, $5 trillion more. Investors and corporations have gotten $10 trillion in tax cuts. And, you know, they say it's going to create jobs. Well, yeah, you're going to get a gig job. You can use your car and drive around, right? Or some other part-time temp work. That's the kind of jobs you get to get. And the other side gets to keep $10 trillion. Well, people are figuring all that out, you know. American people aren't stupid. And after a while, they figure out what the game is, and they look around to their devastated neighborhoods and everything, and they say, gee, I think we need something different. I don't care who it is and what it is. You know, that was one of the problems. As crazy as Trump was, the message was something different. And the big problem with Hillary was, I'm part of the same thing, right? There was no change message from Hillary. It was more of the same. And people read that. And that election was lost in that manufacturing arc from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin that I predicted would be the core of the loss. And who voted? You know, it was the white working class. And, you know, also the Latino and even the African-American working class. voted. She lost from like 8-10% turnout that Obama got in 2008. She ended up with less, 8-10%. And all the key categories, you know, the Latino vote, the African-American vote, which is working class vote, you know, and now the white working class, and youth. They didn't turn out for her. And in fact, some of them actually turned out and voted for Trump, especially the white, non-college educated working class. I predicted that was going to happen back in August. Read my blog. And, you know, read the latest summary here on my blog, jackerasmus.com, Why Trump Won and What's Next. So let's talk about what's next. What are the consequences, economic? You know, we can talk about political consequences for hours, but what are some of the economic consequences of this election and the Trump victory, both for the U.S. economy and for the global economy? This is a game changer. If, of course, Trump delivers on all the stuff he said, he may have just been pandering and lying like politicians typically do, and does not plan to do a lot of what he promised to do, but there are certain things he will do. You know, he will give the deep six to Obamacare. He will pass big corporate tax cuts. He will propose some kind of infrastructure spending program. And he will gut the last vestiges of Dodd-Frank financial regulation. Okay. He'll do a lot of other things, too. Well, let's look at what are these economic consequences. Right. Well, you could see it immediately in the stock market, right? The stock market boomed, and it still is. Investors see, oh, gee, an opportunity to make even more money than we made under Obama and Bush. Well, where are they going to make that money? Well, infrastructure spending. The government is going to release big contracts for construction, commercial property and other construction. You know, and some of that will, you know, will include, you know, infrastructure and so forth. We'll see where it goes. But, you know, this infrastructure spending movement was already underway for at least a year. It had been growing in terms of momentum, proposals for infrastructure spending, and not just in the U.S., but in Europe and elsewhere, right? Because it became increasingly obvious that the whole Federal Reserve Central Bank monetary approach of lowering interest rates to bare-bones levels wasn't doing anything except stimulating investments in financial securities and sending the money offshore and being hoarded. That's all it was doing. It was people were hoarding people, investors, corporations, so forth, hoarding the cash, borrowing the money at low rates. And in the case of, you know, companies like Apple and others, you borrow the money. Even though you have $230 billion in cash on hand, you still borrow the money because it's so cheap, and you use that borrowed money to buy back your stock and issue dividends. So you hold on to your cash, and you borrow the money because it's so cheap, and you pay and you know, reward your stockholders big time. That's where the $5 trillion comes from. Partly comes from the huge profits. Profits have doubled, so they got all this cash on hand that they can and do distribute to their stockholders, to shareholders, you know, in dividends and stock buybacks. But then they go and borrow the money at zero, virtually zero interest rates as well, and they distribute that as well. That's how you get this $5 trillion. I mean, it's outrageous. Well, no wonder the record shows, based on IRS tax data, for wealthy, for all households, you know, that the wealthy 1% has garnered 97% of all the income gains since 2010. 97% went to the 1%. Well, you know, $5 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts is a big chunk of that. And the rest of us, you know, our median real wages have stagnated at best. stagnated, haven't grown. Well, you know, people up there in Milwaukee and Detroit and Pittsburgh, you know, they're not stupid. They know that this is what's happening, and they are reminded about the devastation of the communities every day when they walk down the street. You can't blame them for voting anything but the above. Holding their nose, 68% didn't like him, Trump, held their nose and voted for him. They just can't stand what exists any longer. I can understand that. You know, and it's not that they're racist or misogynist, everybody out there, you know. That's the intellectual left labeling, you know, this working class. There's elements, okay, but label them as, oh, this is an anti-racist vote or racist vote or, you know, people, because they vote for Trump, they're all misogynist. You know, that's the stupid left and the intellectual left in this country. Okay, so stock booming because of infrastructure spending coming and because of big tax cuts coming. Boy, the tax cuts are going to come real fast. Watch it. Because that's been in the works for 2 years now as well. And we'll talk about and watch that. I'll talk about that a little bit more here today, but we'll watch that very closely. Your big corporate tax cuts coming. Right? Infrastructure spending contracts by the government coming. Stocks boom even more now. What else is going to happen? Well, you know, we may get some price increases, some inflation coming as a result of this increased demand going on with the infrastructure spending. Commodity prices are already beginning to rise after they've been deflated significantly, particularly copper. Look at the copper price escalating rapidly because they expect the infrastructure spending coming. And we'll get some price increases, and, you know, that won't help people without wage growth, of course, inflation. All right, bond interest rates have risen just this past week, the fastest in, since 1991, 26 years, fastest escalation, acceleration of bond rates. The Federal Reserve will now definitely 99.9% raise interest rates for sure in a couple of weeks in December, and I predict there'll be other increases in the spring. Right? Now, the higher rates are going to benefit the banks. Yeah, the banks benefited from low rates, but now they're going to benefit from higher rates because it'll increase in another way. It'll increase the rate spread. Right, they'll be able to charge even more, and that will boost their profits. It will also benefit insurance companies, pension funds, and other shadow banks because they were in deep trouble here. You know, with rates so low for so long, they can't cover their liabilities. You see, so banks, insurance companies, pensions. Pension funds, you know, the banks, insurance companies will, you know, already see in their stock price surge as a result. So they love it. They love the higher bond rates, and they love the stock boom. You know, they'll make fees on selling both, right? This is a short-term effect of rising rates. Longer-term, rising rates will probably exacerbate the decline in real investment that's been going on. Although, you know, we'll have the real investment going on in infrastructure, but other forms of real asset investment will be depressed by the higher interest rates. So it'll be a mixed bag here as far as interest rates are concerned. Janet Yellen will leave. Probably replaced, she's the chair of the Federal Reserve, probably replaced by Vice Chair Fisher. Or maybe another appointment by Trump himself. Okay, so stocks booming, first thing. All right, we'll continue. Bond rates surging, benefiting banks. There'll be some job creation from construction. But, you know, this infrastructure construction, the job increases are not that great, and they're temporary. They tend to be temporary. You know, after you build the bridge or the road or whatever, you know, the jobs go away. There's not a lot of long-term permanent jobs, and that would be in manufacturing. And we're not going to see any significant increase in manufacturing jobs. Right? The tax cuts will be just another way allowing manufacturing companies to replace labor with new capital, this trend that I've been talking about. Right? They're not going to bring back manufacturing jobs. construction jobs, you know, construction is housing and so forth is always a quick fix to the economy. If you want to get a quick boost, you know, you somehow stimulate housing and commercial construction, and that's what this is all about, except it's got an infrastructure emphasis to it. So not many jobs. Short-term, yes, but long-term, not many jobs, right? Probably more capital-intensive, right? Is another result here. As I said a while ago, big corporate tax cuts. Again, under Bush, Bush cut taxes by $3.4 trillion, 80% of which went to businesses and investors while he was in office. Obama comes in office as part of his 2009 recovery program, $300 billion in tax cuts. He vetoes Congress efforts to add consumer tax cuts to the mix because Larry Summers told them they couldn't do that. You know, Summers, a representative of the bankers. So we got mostly, again, business tax cuts. And then in 2010, he extends the Bush tax cuts for another 2 years at a cost of $450 billion. And then at the end of 2012, he cuts this deal called the fiscal cliff, which extends the Bush tax cuts for another 10 years at a cost of $5 trillion. So about $6 trillion of tax cuts under Obama, $3.4 trillion under Bush. That's almost $10 trillion. Right? And what did we get in terms of jobs? You know, this whole fiction that tax cuts create jobs is just BS. They don't create jobs. In fact, they kill jobs if the tax cuts are really incentives to take the jobs offshore, which they were, or to replace labor with capital, which they were. They destroy jobs, but yet they have this fiction that people still believe, and economists still believe that nonsense too, mainstream economists, that tax cuts create jobs. They don't. Just the opposite. I mean, look at the record. That's the proof. And now Trump is going to want to cut taxes along the same lines, another $10 trillion. And at least that's what he was saying earlier in the year. Go back and read my blog, you know, when I reviewed the tax proposals back in February, jackrasmus.com, of all the Republicans, including him. Right? Another element of this boondoggle that's coming real quick may even come before he gets sworn in January, right, is this repatriation of offshore profits. You know, under Obama, he did nothing about the fact that these corporations were, Apple and all of them, are holding all this profit offshore. A minute ago I said Apple had $230 billion in cash on hand. 90% of that is held in their offshore subsidiaries, so they don't have to pay taxes. And Obama did nothing about it. Why? Because the Democrats, you know, are tied into Silicon Valley, and they get a lot of campaign contributions from Silicon Valley. So, you know, they went slow. Did nothing. Well, part of this tax cut, and this has been brewing for some time here over the past year, is that they're going to allow these corporations, Apple and his friends, pharma companies and so forth, to bring that cash hoard back to the U.S., and instead of paying 35% corporate tax rate on it, they'll get to pay 8%. 8%. And they'll say, oh, okay, you get to bring it back at 8%, providing you create jobs. And they'll say, yeah, we'll create jobs. But, you know, this scenario has already been run back in 2005 under Bush. Same thing happened. All this offshore tax cash hoarding to avoid taxes. And they bring the money back, promise to create jobs. What did they do with the money? The mergers and acquisitions, stock buybacks, and so forth. All of that. And they didn't create jobs, and they got to pay 5.25%, you see. So they're just rerunning this scam here, promising to bring back, I don't know what it is, there's at least $2 trillion in these offshore subsidiaries. You know, they say it's, what, 1.3 or 4 or something. There's $2 trillion at least offshore, you know. That's what they report. They don't tell you what they parked, you know, in these tax shelters, you know, in the Caribbean and elsewhere. Right? Okay, so that'll be part of the scam, the tax scam, right? And they're not going to create any jobs with that, but they're going to fatten the coffers of their friends. You see, there's this continuity in the policies of all of these presidential candidates. They're all neoliberal, you know, just a different emphasis here or there. You know, we're going to see a different emphasis with Trump here on infrastructure, right? We saw a different emphasis with Obama, right? And with Bush and before that free trade with you know, Clinton, and it goes back to Reagan. You see, it's just they're just shifting a little bit here. They're not changing anything fundamentally, and they're taking care of their wealthy investors and corporate friends, all of them. And they promise these change, right? Remember what Obama promised? Change. That's why everyone went for him. And then in 2012, he said, oh, give me another chance, one more chance. Well, they gave him another one more chance. And who turned his reelection for him? Well, it was the same groups. The white working class in the Midwest, Latinos, and youth put him over in the key states that gave him the electoral victory. Well, those same people in those same key states had said enough is enough in 2016, and they said no. What else can we expect economically, domestically here with the Trump economic consequences? We talked about booming stock market. The banks are able to charge higher interest rates, right? Some construction jobs, not many. Big tax cuts. The big pharmaceutical companies now will be given, are given, have been given a green light to price gouge even more. You know, they were killing us with these price, literally killing us with these prescription drug increases, driving up health interest, health premiums, health insurance premiums as a result, right? And now they got a green light. All this token talk, you know, the past year, well, we got to do something about price gouging in Congress, gone. Green light, raise your prices some more, right? The same with the health insurance companies, the Aetnas and so forth, you know, who were gaming the system and then threatening to pull out and so forth. Now, here come the increases, health premium increases, right? We already have a problem with the ACA, Obamacare, in that the current increases are so significant already that all the people can afford who are going on ACA, most of them is high deductible plans, right? So all I can afford. High deductible, I'm talking about $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a year deductibles. You don't get a penny of insurance payment until you pay out of pocket $5,000. That's very typical. It's collapsed, you see, because they never got to the 35 million signups that they had to make it profitable according to the health insurance companies. They were willing to play ball, as long as you give us 35 million new customers. Well, what did they get? They got about 10 million, another 10 million on Medicaid. By the way, that was a good element of ACA. I'm not totally against ACA. You know, the there are some provisions in ACA which were okay. But the problem is they could never control the costs. Look, Obamacare was a strategy to split the opposition. The opposition, being health insurance companies and all the rest of the corporate and big business friends of healthcare, make money off of healthcare price gouging for decades. Okay, split them by getting the health insurance companies on your side by promising them 35 million customers. And to do that, ACA had to raise $900 billion a year, and part of it from all different sources, because the government had to subsidize those making $40,000 and below, subsidize the health insurance premium. So they, you know, the plan was designed to get money from different directions. That's why small businesses hated the plan, because there's a wealth tax associated with that. They hated the wealth tax, you see. Surtax on certain income levels. So that was source of a lot of opposition. And the idea was to get the health insurance companies on your side to pass this thing, right? And that's what it did, but the health insurance companies started backing out of this thing and raising prices and so forth anyway, because they weren't making the profits they thought they would make with only 10 million to 35 million customers. So it's imploding. It's imploding on itself. Bad formula, bad, you know. If there had been a public option, it would have worked. But Obama unilaterally pulled that off the table real quick. And the Democrats would not even allow discussion on whether Medicare for all was an option. They shut that down immediately. I mean, here's the party that championed Medicare back in the 1960s and Social Security in general in the 30s, you know. Instead of expanding it and improving it, shut it down. And they could have expanded and improved it because Obama had an airtight Congress, controlled the Senate, controlled the House. He could have done it in the first 2 years. And that's when, you know, in 2010, that's when it was passed. He could have done it, but he decided not to, right? His corporate advisors in the Democratic Party convinced him not to. And we see the consequence of this, right? The ACA is going to be an early prime target of Trump. Is he going to repeal it? I don't think repeal it all at once, you know. You can kill it, allow it to die simply by reversing, pulling this individual mandate requirement to buy insurance. So you don't require people to buy insurance anymore, and the whole thing dies financially, right? Some states are going to pull out of the Medicaid coverage element of it. Many of them refuse to participate, which is unfortunate, because the Medicaid coverage is about the only good thing, you know, with a few other elements in it about, you know, no limits, and can't refuse customers and keep kids until they're 26, you know, those three things. But, you know, those three things cost $900 billion a year. You look, the ACA is not a health reform act. It is a Health Insurance Company Subsidy Act. That's what it is. And what's going to come after it? Well, you know, we may see a resurrection of Bush's health savings accounts. We may see allowing, with as premiums go up, allowing people to deduct their health insurance premiums from their income taxes. Mm-hmm. Select provisions may be kept. Well, certainly the wealth tax element will be repealed. I don't think they're just going to repeal it all at once. I think they're going to selectively slice and dice it, and when they're done, it'll be gone. Right? Another thing immediately for repeal here or change is the Dodd-Frank Financial Banking Regulation Act, a very weak act nonetheless, but the good part of that act is the Consumer Protection Agency within the act. Financial protections for consumers, they're going to go after that. You know, they'll either totally defund it or some other way they'll gut it, right? And there'll probably be other changes that the banks have wanted, you know, some leftovers that they haven't already eliminated. You know, it was a weird act anyway. They passed this act in 2010, and then they give 4 years for the bank lobbyists to pick the rest of it apart. I mean, that was, you know, the way they did that, it was pretty obvious that it was just a passage at the time to make it look like they were doing something about the banking crisis. And, you know, allow the banks to later on recoup their positions. Okay, but ACA and Dodd-Frank will be early targets, and they'll be gutted pretty quick. And we're going to see escalation of health premiums and prescription drug prices even more. And big corporate tax cuts, as I said. Stock markets will boom. What else? Alternative energy. You'll see the repeal of the credits for alternative energy here. You know, the 30% put solar panels on your house and 50% credits for businesses that try to produce alternative energy products. Yeah, that'll be pretty quick, too. Oh, Keystone Pipeline, here it comes. Standing Rock? Yeah, they're in trouble, too. EPA proposals on industrial plant emissions. That's going to be gutted. That won't go through, right? It's going to very much look like under Reagan, you know, when we had that dodo there running the Interior Department. I forget his name. But they'll just pull the plug on the funding, as they did under Reagan and under George W. Bush. And Trump will just quietly refuse to implement the Paris climate deal, and that will unravel. Okay, we're going to see a boost in more fracking, more pipeline production, right? Coal industry, coal production, all of that is going to be a consequence. Now, there's a positive thing here about the Federal Reserve rate increases. You know, it doesn't benefit just all banks, bankers. But finally, mom and pop, grandma and grandpa, who are on fixed incomes, retirees, will be able to get a little bit of savings increase, you know, from their CDs and whatever. But, of course, they're going to have to pay more for Medicare, you know, and that's going to go up. You know, the monthly cost of Medicare contribution will go up. A renewed attack by the Ryan crew, Paul Ryan crew and so forth, on Social Security is going to also be on the agenda. I'm not so sure how much they're going to get away with that, though. We'll see. But they really want to get their claws into the Social Security Trust Fund, particularly retirement fund that still has a surplus. You see, the banks want to take that money and get you to put it into stocks, so that they can rip you off again another way. They did that with pensions when they destroyed real pensions and replaced them with 401k plans, right? Well, they want to do the same thing with Social Security. Bush tried that, but he was beaten back. But now we're going to see another effort on that. Republicans, when they come in, they always go after Social Security, right? So, you know, a real defense has to be levied there. The infrastructure spending and the big tax cuts are going to cause an acceleration in federal deficits and therefore the debt. Right? They're going to try to make it up by cutting entitlements, as they say. Trade off Social Security for business investor tax cuts. Right? They're probably going to attack SSI, which is the Social Security Disability Fund, and Medicare itself, and raise the age on retirement. That's how those three areas are prime targets for going after Social Security, right? Okay. On this question of infrastructure spending, you know, I think it's going to be insufficient You know, even Hillary was talking about this $250 billion infrastructure spending plan over 5 years. So $50 billion a year. That's not enough. Hell, we give $50 billion a year in agricultural price subsidies and supports. We spend that much, you know, paying the sugar industry and the rest of them, agribusiness, direct subsidies, payments, right? $50 billion a year is not enough. Plus, these infrastructure programs, many of them take time and they're capital intensive, as I said. Plus, I would add this. I believe that the multiplier, this is an economist thing, the multiplier effect is quite low now for government spending. I was arguing for quite some time that the effect of lowering interest rates on stimulating real investment was only about 20% of a one. You know, multiplier would mean, okay, I'm going to spend $100 billion and then I'm going to get $200 billion in GDP. Right? $200 billion, that's a multiplier of two. That's a multiplier of two. Okay, I think it's collapsed. Just as the monetary policy interest rate elasticity did collapse. In other words, we were only for every $5 of QE and injection of monetary stimulus over the last 8 years, we got only $1 of real investment. The rest, of course, was going offshore into financial assets, which don't create any jobs, or it was just being hoarded, or all three. Well, I think we're going to be surprised that this infrastructure spending, the multiplier is not that great either. It's not going to stimulate the entire economy. You'll get a little bump for a while, but that'll be it. It might be enough to avoid the recession that was coming in 2017 in the U.S., you know, this short-term bump. Right. Okay, what else are we going to get under Trump? Deregulation, right? And we're going to get a very harsh immigration, deregulation across the board. And we're going to get a terrible immigration bill now. And Latinos are going to take it in the neck here with this. Forget the DREAM Act and all those executive orders. They'll be immediately repealed. Okay, so what's going to happen offshore? Well, you know, what are economic consequences for the world? Well, we're already seeing it. The Fed rate increase is coming, and anticipating that, the dollar is rising, right? And bond prices, without longer-term interest rates, which the Fed doesn't have anything to do with, are already escalating record levels, like I said, just in 1 week. And what's happening? Well, when the dollar rises and rates rise in the U.S., currencies collapse elsewhere around the world. And we're seeing currency collapse now, not just in Mexico, but all around the world in the emerging markets. And when their currencies collapse, we get capital flight out of those markets, and we get deeper recessions. Emerging markets are in deep doo-doo all around the world if the Trump follows through on all of this, right? If Fed rates and dollars keep rising. And as dollar rises, oil prices decline. So countries like Venezuela are in deeper problems. Right. The Chinese currency, the yuan, is at the lower level of its band, trading band, to the U.S. dollar, because it's pegged to the dollar. You know, this talk about China currency manipulators. No, it's pegged to the dollar, has been for over a decade now. But it's trading at its lower level. And if it breaks through that lower level band, that will cause another round of currency collapse all around the world. Currency wars will intensify. And what does that mean? That means to lower their currencies, Europe and Bank of Japan will continue to pump QE money into their economies to compete with the lower interest, lowered currency exchange rate values elsewhere. All this is a little bit arcane, maybe, to some of you, but it's very real. Believe me. So Trump is going to mean big trouble for the rest of the world economy. Now, he also talks about NAFTA and free trade and so forth. We'll see what he goes after in terms of NAFTA. I think he'll use it as an excuse for we got to lower taxes here in order to attract U.S. businesses to come back from Mexico. I'm not sure what he's going to do about NAFTA, but he's going to do something, that's for sure. Now, TPP, right, Trans-Pacific Partnership, is that dead? We'll see. We'll see. Of course, he was against TPP and TTIP, which is the Europe. The Europe version of TTIP is dead, you know, because you've got Britain pulling out of the European Union, and you'll soon have others doing the same as Europe unravels here. Watch the elections in France and Germany next year. Could be very much like Brexit Trump. You know, the National Front right wing in France could prevail in the election there because the so-called socialist government, is Francois Hollande, the president, has approval rating of about 5%. Socialist Party in France is done. Toast. Gone. It will never recover. And that means it will open up, as in Europe, other challenging parties from the left and right. Well, the National Front is a right-wing party, very similar in some ways to Trump's movement. And they could pull France out of the EU. It could have a Frexit here. Well, not just a Brexit. You know, Europe is in trouble long-term here. And the TTIP, which was like a Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade deal with the U.S., that's done. You know, not going to happen. I mean, Europe could barely get an agreement here with Canada recently on a trade deal. You know, and they're certainly not going to get it with the U.S. Right? Okay. So those are some of the consequences long term. I think they'll try to ram through TPP anyway, here, even before Trump gets into office. If he turns a blind eye, that will tell you a lot about his real policies in this area. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus. We'll be following up on this next week. Who are these appointees to the Trump economic and political team? That's going to be interesting.